This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 18th of June 2013, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on today's show, we take a tour of the new improved Terminal 2 building at London's Heathrow Airport with architect Louis Vidal.
Because it really lifts your spirit. It actually, you know, you're coming into a country. This is the doorway to London.
We flex our noses at a bespoke perfume maker in Singapore.
What I'm trying to do is just create a very specific experience, a very specific moment in time, place in time, that you took something into your life.
And we'll take a tour of the Bartlett School's intriguing exhibition, Atlas of the Unbuilt World.
I think it's exciting for the architects that are actually here as well to see what else is happening in other parts of the world which they may or may not be working in, and just to take that knowledge and that little snippet of what they've seen here and talk about it elsewhere.
Elsewhere, we'll road test OMA's debut furniture collection for Knoll. We'll drop into the studio of New York designer Lindsay Adelman, and we'll be seeing how design can be a motor for industrial revival at a new exhibition in Madrid too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's show in West London. Anyone who's been to Heathrow Airport in the last few years might have wondered what's going on with Terminal 2. It's been under refurbishment, of course, and a much-needed one at that. Though it won't open to the public until next year, eagle-eyed visitors to the outer reaches of Terminal 1 can see behind the hoardings that it's shaping up very nicely indeed. Alid John, Section D's producer, is more eagle-eyed than most. He took a tour of the new improved, nearly finished Terminal 2 with the architect Louis Vidal, responsible for the project. And here's what he found.
On the floor of Heathrow's new Terminal 2, construction is still very much underway. The noise of the final touches being added to this six-year-long project clattering constantly in the background.
Wow. The size of it is amazing. It's huge.
There are over 2,000 contractors on any given day. Architects, engineers, workmen and women navigating their way through the fabric of the building site and implementing the designs of Louis Vidal Architects, the Madrid-based firm that won the contract in the wake of the departure of Foster's and Partners. At over 200,000 metres squared, the time taken for this project to be realised and the cost, some £880 million, comes as no surprise. Louis Vidal himself takes us on a tour of the terminal.
I think this is one of the very few buildings in the world where you will be able to see airside from landside. So from here, you will see the plane is over there. And that is an enormous success. So passengers will very quickly and immediately understand my plane is over there.
The structure of the building, divided along three floors, allowing linear routes and clear line of sight from nose to tail, attempts to place the journey of the passenger at the forefront of the design.
We feel that part of reducing that passenger anxiety is to make an ample space like this with sufficient natural light, which is, you know, open, transparent, so that you don't really feel so much oppressed. So that's really one of the reasons why this space is so big and, you know, under this second bolt. And again, very important for passengers. You have a view out, you can see the sky, you can see if it's sunny, you can see if it's raining, you can see if it's at night time. That again gives psychologically passengers some comfort. So they really are coming from a long haul flight or they're transferring. They really don't know what time of day it is. This allows them to be in a more calm and relaxing atmosphere. Very important to me was to make people aware of the sky, of the light that's happening outside. So that's why we have so much light. Not only to make the building flooded with light, but to people to actually see out there and, understand, oh, today is cloudy, today is sunny, today is rainy.
So the idea, when you arrive, you don't look at the floor, you look at the ceiling.
Exactly.
Why is that so important to you?
Because it really lifts your spirit. It actually, you know, you're coming into a country. This is the doorway to London. And if you're really coming into somewhere where you want to celebrate, you want to, you know, uplift the spirit of passengers, you really want them to look up. You don't want them to look down.
Light and space are the themes of the day and the undoubted focus of the terminal's development. The passengers' ease of travel and peace of mind are something the architects stress are crucial to this terminal's success, as David Perez, one of the project architects who has worked on the terminal from day one, notes.
One of the advantages of having such an open space is orientation. So the passenger can feel, as Luis was saying before, oriented in his way to his flight, or he can feel comfortable and do his shopping while he knows what he has to do, he knows what time of day it is.
It's such a high premium put onto the softness of structure as well as space and light.
Well, you see, as it was done in Barajas, the experiment of adding Barajas T4, which was Luis was director for that project, there was a warmth to the materials used in the soffit as well, in the ceiling as well, which makes, again, it's an element that reduces the stress of the passenger. It makes you feel sort of at home. It's not such an industrial cold building where you're detached from, but you're feeling safe and protected, and you're enjoying, you know, daylight, the view of the sky, whatever it is.
We do buildings that normally handle and take care of people. So we design airports thinking on passengers. We design hospitals thinking on patients. And we always put our users first on our buildings.
How can you work towards doing that with architecture? There's a mixture between functionality and kind of attractive design as well. How can you mix the two to create an experience for the passenger which isn't anxious or stressful?
Well, I think the way we work is we don't do one thing and then another one. We do both things at the same time. So we will be working on all the functional aspects of a building, and at the same time we will be using a number of resources to make our building special. So legibility, orientation, wayfinding, color, texture, lighting, all those elements we use on our designs, and they in a way inform and help us achieve our end results.
Did you have to consider the structures already in Heathrow, or did you approach the project thinking this is a blank canvas and we're going to do whatever we like within the specifications of the other parties that you had to bear in mind?
We had carte blanche. We were not imposed any type of stylistic or references. So we really approached the building starting from full freedom. We were allowed to do our proposal as we did.
Having just spent 2 hours walking around the terminal under construction as it is, there's a high premium put on space and sort of openness of design, and the other factor is light, obviously a very important factor for you as an architect.
Our motto when we started this design was putting passengers first, and BAA was very much aligned with this motto, and at the same time they spoke about a world-class terminal. Heathrow is spending an extreme amount of money in upgrading their facilities and providing first-class terminals for its passengers. So our challenge was to design a very functional building, which is flexible, but at the same time, which is a world-class terminal, and puts passengers first. And that we have done with space, as you say, with light, a lot of natural light, and again, with other subtle things that maybe they're not so aware for the passenger, but they help and add onto those things, like, you know, the right use of color, the acoustics of the terminal. There's a lot of effort that has gone onto the soffit. The soffit is not only helping to bounce the light, but it's got a micro perforation that will help the acoustics of the terminal. So important when you are in a public space and you want to be calm, you cannot have sound bouncing around.
The roof is obviously an identifying factor for you as an architect. You look at some of your other work, there is a kind of leitmotif going through the rolling roof. Very, very important here and very striking. Is it only to do with identifying with the passengers which stage of their departure or arrival they're in, or is there more to it? Does the design affect their anxiety, their stress?
Again, I think it does both. Most of our airports have a curved roof, but not all have three curves. Normally the curves respond to the function that is happening beneath. And therefore, it happens here in Heathrow that we had three main functions, like check-in, security, and boarding gates, so that's why we have the three waves. But again, when people enter the building, they normally look at the floor. In this case, people look up, because they are inspired by the structure, the size, the acoustics, and especially the light. So really, those are three waves that are surfing, and then they're tilted to the north to allow natural light in. For a number of reasons, tilted to the north. The north light is the most homogeneous light, so it's more constant in terms of light quality, and also because it's tilted to the north, it's not receiving any direct solar radiation, so therefore it's helping also with the energy consumption of the building. You have to heat it less.
What challenges did you face to incorporate functionality, energy efficiency as well, and in fact also attractive design?
I think the challenges throughout a complex design process like this is trying to make everyone aligned and focus on the broad issues that a complex building like this has. So you really have to bring together the interests of the owner of a building, the user of a building, the client of a building, and everything else that happens in a building like this, like customs, police, maintenance, supplies. So really, it's been a combination of a lot of hard work made of huge and wonderful teams that have been putting the important issues on the agenda and have been making people aware that all those things, 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1, at the end, add up to an exceptional building.
Thank you very much, Alid. Bon voyage. That's Alid John, our Section D producer there with Luis Vidal, the architect behind the new improved Heathrow Terminal 2. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Lots more coming up, including a look at OMA's debut furniture range for Knoll and a visit to the Bartlett School of Architecture too. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily Monocolumn Bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 2525 City Guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Section D. We're in Singapore now. Not the first place you might think to head to hunt for a fragrance, but there is indeed a lot more to be found beyond the bounds of duty-free. Our lady there, Kate Lam, dropped in on local perfumer Yohari Kazura to talk olfactory fashion and bespoke fragrances.
The come hither eyes of starlets and the seeming ease of opulence is the standard face of modern perfumery. But long before Brad Pitt sold his soul to Chanel, the art of perfume making was much more down to earth.
This is actually agarwood, oud. This has become a really quite a popular ingredient in a lot of Western perfumes now, but humans have been using it for thousands of years. You can, I think, find mention of it in texts from Cleopatra's time, you know, it was part of her perfume. This is one of the ways to enjoy smells, one of the original ways, you know, fire and smoke.
That's bespoke perfumer Johari Kazura. He's tinkering around with a chalice and some charcoal inside his workshop and boutique perfumery in Singapore's Arab Quarter.
And actually what I have here is a little flex of frankincense. And that too goes onto the charcoal. A lot of people compare the smell of this to drinking brandy. You know, you'll smell the things like the oak, the burnt cherries, you know, and it's a warm, comforting note, you know. This would be a classic example of a warm note.
A third-generation perfumer, Kazura grew up around scent, running around his grandfather's old shop house that was opened in 1933. As a boy, he says he was always playing mad scientist, mixing different liquids together and learning how to distinguish individual smells from, in his words, a cacophony of scent.
Other than a little bit of time that I spent down in grass, most of what I know comes from being the mad scientist and just playing with these random vials that I have and trying to remember what they did.
But Kazura says there is an art to it, and it's all about paying attention to your senses. Kazura's Solitique Perfumer's organ or workstation, a major feature in his shop, is home to hundreds of bottles of exotic ingredients or notes. Indian sandalwood, white amber, and Moroccan and Bulgarian rose. The shelves of vials and small glass beakers, all signs of the bespoke process. The boutique store Cypher blends the ancient art of perfume making with a modern vintage aesthetic. And while it is distinctly his own thing, there are echoes of his grandfather all over. They even use the same suppliers.
My grandfather actually passed away when I was really young, but I actually have some of his travel books in an old weathered address book, except all the letters, they were not of names of people, but they were just contacts in countries. And in each one of them, he'd have the name of the company that he went to see and the product that he got from them. And this is back in the day in the 30s.
And the same jars.
I still use them. You know, they're just great jars to use. I mean, they're scientific looking jars, but they serve their purpose. And they're still around.
The shop is also home to a collection of rare perfume bottles. There are some with swoopy tails and even vintage boxes that look like old lighters, actually dapper atomizers made to fit in men's breast pockets. One of Kazura's favourites is by French bottle maker Marcel Frank.
If you just look at the bottle, you can kind of tell the Art Deco style, which should place it in the somewhere around the 20s or so. And this is an atomizer. And there's a really special thing. I'm going to open this really carefully.
He points out the tiny glass tube, a rarity in the modern era of plastic. Such passion and attention to detail also applies to how Kazura creates bespoke perfumes. What he says is about creating memories in time.
What I'm trying to do is just create a very specific experience, a very specific moment in time, place in time that you took something into your life.
For Monocle, from a moment in time in an olfactory haven in Singapore. This is Kate Lamb.
Thank you for that, Kate. You're listening to Section D. We shift to Spain now, and more precisely to the Madrid City Hall, where a new exhibition, Fuera de Serrella, is showcasing some of the practical virtues of design. The collection is intended to trumpet all the requisite design buzzwords of late: smart, dynamic, sustainable. But at a time when Spain's unemployment crisis is biting hard, curator Ana Dominguez wanted to show Spaniards that good design can be a motor for industry too. The exhibition includes a plethora of international talent, but she has placed a deliberate focus on local Spanish designers. Our correspondent Liam Aldous set out to talk to those involved.
I had to think of something that could be read at a very basic level for everyone. It came with this idea of showing projects that where design is important in the way that can change things that already exist and give it a different meaning.
I'm talking to design journalist and curator Ana Dominguez, whose latest exhibition, Fuera de Serie, is as much a celebration of design as it is a didactic display of its potential.
We're having this horrible recession, so it's also a way of showing people ideas or how can they use what they have in a different way to survive this crisis. Many people think that this exhibition is about craftsmanship, which is many of the projects, it's true that many of the projects are craft-based, but it's not only that. It's also, I'm showing some industrial process that have been changed or, you know, that had a witty way of looking at them by the designer. In this case, for example, there is a table by Jaime Ayón, which is for a company called SE in London. And what Jaime did is a metallic table that would have been very expensive to do if they didn't find the molds with which the front of planes are made. So they found this little factory in France. They found a cemetery of molds that are not used anymore, and they used one of these molds to make this table. So it's an ingenious way of using the process, and it's industrial.
This is a common concern in Spain's design community. The gradual erosion of industry has left many designers without a leg to stand on. So, while there may be a surplus of talent and creativity, a dwindling manufacturing sector means that much of it doesn't get far from the designer floor.
If you look at the shapes, they are amazing because they come from old lamps. So we cut them in different places, no? So you really see in some vases and some glasses where the oil lamp was, but as it was a functional object, the shapes are very simple, and that was very good for doing the designs.
Paloma Cañizares from PCM Design believes that artists and industry should collaborate more. She's also the driving force behind a unique project that has seen Slovakian glassware extraordinaire Thomas Kral collaborate with the Spanish royal glassware manufacturer La Real Granja de San Ildefonso.
The problem is that La Granja closed from 1890 to 1980, so almost 100-year close, so they didn't develop anything in the 20th century. So really, this was the first contemporary project they made. Well, it was in the 21st century, but it was quite interesting for them to work on something new, because really what they are focused on is on reproductions of the crystalware from 19th and 18th century. So really this was like a lot of fresh air for them. The collaboration started because I was working with Thomas Kral on some projects, and he has a long tradition from where he's from. He's from Slovakia with crystal. So I wanted to do a crystal project, but with Spanish crystal. So I went to La Granja de San Ildefonso, which is the most renowned. We asked them if they wanted to do a project, and they were very open. And so we started looking at what they had from their historical like archives. And we saw these molds from the 18th and 19th century. And we thought it was interesting to work with what they had and apply their techniques to the drawings and designs of Thomas Kral.
Known as the Reused History Project, Thomas Kral's glassware designs were a bestseller, throwing a much-needed lifeline to the ailing La Granja. But while Paloma may be helping to unite talents, she believes that the economic crisis isn't the only reason some of Spain's centuries-old craftsmanship is locked in a state of atrophy.
Their main problem is that they don't know how to update and how to focus on giving solutions to the new needs of the people. No, they still think the clients would be the same classic clients from always, but the truth is that the clients are changing their tastes and they don't really want the same objects from 19th and 18th century.
Another ubiquitous object from the 21st century that people just don't seem to want is the plastic bottle. However, designer Álvaro Catalán de Ocón has brought new meaning to the old adage, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
This is a project which is radically different to what I have done before, because before I have always worked with industry. This time the aim was to work with artisans and bonded to one of the most industrial products on earth, which is a plastic bottle, the PET bottle.
Working with indigenous artisans from the Amazon in Colombia, Alvaro's design for slicing up discarded plastic bottles allowed the local artisans to weave in their own unique textile patterns to create a colourful array of lampshades.
We first called four artisans. Next day came seven, because the grandfather and the nephew and the brother and the sister, and then the next day they were 15, and now we have like 30 of them working on the project, no? And you see that it grows and grows and grows, and that's in a way what we want, no? We want it to spread. The colors and the patterns are completely free for the artisan to choose, no? Because we didn't want to influence in something that they are really expert in that, no? So why should we tell them what to do from our point of view, which is probably not as rich as his? Our main interest was to take the project into the design world and not keep it as an artisan piece, no? And, well, I have access through my previous work to big shops and retailers. So it was interesting to give that radicality to the project, in the sense that it's a product that has been thrown away in a street in Colombia, in Bogota, picked up by an artisan, made a lampshade, sent to Europe, to Spain, built the lamp with that here in Madrid in my studio, and then taken to the most important fair in Milan, to the most important gallery probably in Milan, Rosana Orlandi, where we actually hanged 90 lamps. So it has been like a really, really big installation, no? And it has proved super success. We have been really shocked by the response. Well, I think it's been also very successful in a way that we tried to not take the European style to a tropical country, but bring the tropical country style into Europe, no? And with this crisis and with this dullness, no, and everything seems to be grey, and we brought up these colourful tropical patterns and shapes, and it's like a party, no, and it's full of colours and the cables and the lamps and floating in the air, and people like felt it was a very fresh idea.
Alvaro's transatlantic project is a vivid example of what can happen when various sectors work together to achieve a common goal. Collaboration that most Spanish designers would surely agree is the key to their survival.
It was nearly like an impossible project with 1,000 pieces. It was like an enormous puzzle, which each piece needed to fit its place in order to work. And it magically fitted.
For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Thank you, Liam. Now time for our weekly studio visit. And this week we're off to the Big Apple. Lindsay Adelman's design career started with a light installation she put together in a Brooklyn townhouse. When the neighbours around started asking for similar chandeliers, she knew she was onto something. 7 years later, she has her own studio in Manhattan. And with a thoughtful approach to detail and an emphasis on quality and not quantity, she's grown into a business of 17 people.
It's on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and it's a building of about 200 artists and designers. It's a lot of little spaces, so we just keep taking over more and more spaces and knocking down walls and expanding. We have another space across the hall that's all shipping and receiving, so it's just a lot of armatures for the chandeliers. It looks like a forest of trees. Kevin's there working on ceramics, which is a good example of a lot of how our studio works, where I feel like my role as creative director is more like connecting the dots in a way, and I defer to a lot of the expertise to the people that I work with. So, for instance, Kevin is, you know, came to the studio with a lot of experience in clay, among other materials, and so I can just ask him questions about, will this work? Can we try this, etc. And they can kind of advise me on how to think about form and what's realistic and testing glazes and all that type of thing. Other lighting manufacturers tend to look impersonal in a way. So a bench will be made for a certain type of production, and each bench is sort of designed for a certain type of production. But our studio is more designed so that each person has their own individual bench, and they set it up with the tools that they want, where, and you know, of course, personalize it in any way, but I think in that sense, it feels more satisfying to them as a job. And then here is where one employee, Brett, works, and we call her art department. It's department of one, sort of everything that doesn't fall into the chandelier category. So she does a lot of experimentation. I mean, you see horsehair on her desk, pillows. We're doing this knotted pillow with this snake pattern, and we're doing more jewelry. And so she always has, it's like a mood board all the time in her space. And my space keeps changing over the years. So right now I wouldn't even say I have a space. What I do is more, I'll sketch, whether it's like even out on Long Island, we have a house out there. The gallery space is extremely quiet. So I often will just take my laptop over there to answer emails. I think that I am wary of becoming into a, like falling into a rut or too much of a routine. And that can happen, I think, if you've got a computer set up and you go to the same chair and the same desk and the same computer every single day. I think maybe you close yourself to possibilities sometimes. So I tend to be, and just my nature, I'd rather be moving around. So I tend to mix it up a little bit in terms of where I work. To have my own studio, I think the greatest privilege is that you can constantly evolve the form. So something that maybe I didn't think of 2 years ago, it happened last week, this idea for a bulb. Not really inventing our own light bulb, but something that's that approaches that a little bit. And it was sort of this feeling of, how did I not think of this exact assembly before? And so we're prototyping it now, but I don't think I would necessarily have as many clear ideas if I weren't working hands-on.
We took a peek inside Lindsay's record player too, and found a rather familiar tune that she's currently enjoying. Oh yes, it's Daft Punk. She's up all night to the sun, I'm up all night to get some. She's up all night for good fun, I'm up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to the sun, we're up all night to get some. We're up all night for good fun, we're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky, we're up all night to get lucky. That was, of course, Get Lucky by Daft Punk, featuring the beautiful cat-like vocals of Pharrell Williams. That's designer Lindsay Adelman's choice of song for her studio. You're listening to Section D. Up next, we'll be casting our eye over 64 architectural models at London's Bartlett School of Architecture.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The future of architecture is often discussed as an abstract concept, illustrated with gleaming renderings and CAD drawings to illuminate what the built landscape of our cities will look like in years to come. Atlas of the Unbuilt World is an exhibition that gives a rare, tangible glimpse of the future horizon through a collection of architectural models from around the world. As part of the international programme for the London Architecture Festival, this year the British Council worked with London's embassies and cultural institutes to curate a show with contributions from as many countries as possible. The result is a sea of 64 architectural models from 39 countries, housed in an industrial space in the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. Hazel Pfeiffer was at the opening night with architects from around the world to find out what the future of architecture might look like.
So the idea is this sort of snapshot of architecture from around the world, but it's also an insight into how architects work in different places. So model making tells you quite a lot about the thought process, the attitude to materials, and to the representation of architecture.
Victoria Richardson is Director of Architecture, Design and Fashion at the British Council, and the person responsible for overseeing this mammoth feat of international collaboration.
It's quite exciting, I suppose, because we've got several countries here where we know very little about their architectural culture. So, for example, Bangladesh, there are three projects from Bangladesh, and the models are absolutely stunning. it challenges, I think, our impression that, you know, things are rather basic, and in developing countries, I think we can see actually those highly sophisticated ideas coming from many of the countries from the Southern Hemisphere.
One of my favourite models was from Nigeria, an elegantly organic-looking structure made of bamboo, cardboard and wine corks. Lisa Anderson, executive manager of Enlay, an architecture firm based in Lagos and Amsterdam, talked me through the project.
Well, what we have is the floating prototype structure of Makoko Floating School. It's part of the Lagos Water Communities project. And it's really our way of presenting a possibility of how housing can be developed that is adaptable to the challenges of climate change and urbanisation within Lagos, particularly for Lagos's water-based communities.
And it's a kind of a triangular structure with open and closed sections. And we can see here these little cardboard boats around the outside. So these are the canoes that people row over to the school in.
That's right. So it's based on the lagoon and it's anchored into place because it's a movable floating structure. And the way you do get to it is, yes, through the canoes that people use to navigate through their community. And we're actually doing a larger research project called African Water Cities that's looking into the reality of other water-based communities in cities in Africa that are affected by these issues, because it's something that we think is really, really important to face.
Museums, private houses, floating schools, train stations and university buildings sit side by side, from Serbia to Bangladesh and Egypt to Indonesia, spanning a spectrum of architectural schools and techniques. The materials themselves are just as varied, including polished wood, raw bamboo, plaster of Paris, foam, steel and even Lego. Walking through the aisles of models of all shapes and sizes, there is a Gulliver-like sense of disproportion, and a childlike thrill at peering through windows and into courtyards of what one day will be real.
I'm Lauren McCurdy, I'm from British Council and I'm curator of this exhibition, Atlas of the Unbuilt World for London Festival of Architecture.
Tell me about the curation process for this exhibition.
Okay, so there were two criteria that everybody had to meet. One was that architects had to be based in the country that the building was being built in, and the other was that the projects had to be real, so they had to be under construction or were definitely going to be built in the coming months or years.
You'll have to do a tour of all these countries now to see them up.
Yes, exactly. In maybe 5 years, I can go visit some of them, which I think is what's really exciting about this project. And I think it's exciting for the architects that are actually here as well to come and to see what else is happening in other parts of the world, which they may or may not be working in, and just to kind of contrast and compare and have conversations and take that knowledge and that little snippet of what they've seen here and talk about it elsewhere. That's really nice.
Carolina Neidl from Copa Architects in Denmark was intrigued by the diversity of the exhibition. She showed me her company's model for the busiest train station and public square in Copenhagen.
I think our model is almost quite boring, I have to say. I think it was very exciting to see how many different materials got used and how many different scales. For me, it was really exciting to see the variation of the projects. If you go to Copenhagen to an exhibition or in Denmark, I think the models almost look the same. They have the same material you're using, the same scale.
And how important is the use of models in your work?
It's very important. We start out with sketch models, and it's really that we are actually mass producing models, and we're using foam because it's a quite easy and fast method of making models. And then we actually have like a huge amount of models, and we are tearing them down, so to say, to the best result. And that's also because we are working in teams, and that's the best tool of, you know, communicating to everybody in the team. So for us, it's really, really important. But we start really of trying different volume studies, lots and lots and lots, and then we're getting closer and closer to the final result.
I'm Shahira Fahmi, an Egyptian architect based in Cairo. I have a practice based in Cairo.
So you've got these three beautifully sculptural models here made out of paper. Can you tell me about how they came about?
It's a house overlooking the pyramids, and the land was a big rectangular. We have like a generous land, approximate 4,000 square meters. And one of the restrictions was to have it on one floor. So what we decided to do is to use the land as a like one platform, as if it's a like one piece of A4 paper, and then we try to cut and fold from this single piece of paper, and we try to build layers in the ground and in the sky. So we have like the basement, we carve the gardens, so somehow the house and the garden and the roof are all within one landscape.
One person who knew exactly how much work went into the actual making of the models was Carl Way, model maker and director of 3D Peasy, a new 3D printing company that explores 3D colour printing.
All of these models require a certain amount of translation from a drawing, essentially, that an architect will give you to the model maker to interpret and to understand and produce a model in a way that the architect is happy with, but also translate the design into something that's tangible and understandable as an object. Really, really simple things like panes of glass cannot be scaled down, for example. You know, like a pane of glass will be 5 millimeters thick, but in scale of 1 to 1,000, it becomes nothing. So there's a huge amount of work for the model maker to translate like data or like a design into something smaller but makes sense.
Remarkable in scope and variety, the exhibition is a fascinating insight not only into architecture worldwide over the next few decades, but into the art and craft of the architectural model itself. For Monocle, in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
You're listening to Section D. We're off to Rotterdam next. The relationship between architecture and furniture design is very established, of course. Any architect worth their salt has dabbled in the creation of a perfect interior with movable components that best complement the building they've designed. What's not so common, though, is to see an architecture practice endeavour to develop a furniture range separated from any of the projects they've built. Dutch architecture practice, OMA, headed by Rem Koolhaas, has launched a range that does just that. It's called Tools for Life and has been manufactured by the American brand Knoll. The range strips furniture design right down to the basics, although as Monocle's David Pleasant discovered at OMA's Rotterdam headquarters, simplicity can offer its own design complexities too. Among the printers and model cutting saws, David met some of the people involved in designing the range.
I'm Antonio Barone, I'm an industrial designer, and I started to work here at OMA just a little bit more than 1 year ago, together with Jesuito, to take part in this project for this furniture collection for Knoll International.
My name is Yasuhito Hirose, from Japan.
And we're standing in the OMA offices in Rotterdam with a wonderful view of the rooftops of Rotterdam out of the window. And here we've got some models that kind of explain the whole range of the Tools for Life products.
Knoll gave us a brief, which was talking about collaborative spaces, also something that is in between the office environment and the domestic environment. One specific request will be to have different surfaces at different levels, and they gave us this beautiful tiny Perspex model. And Rem thought those were kind of interesting by themselves because of the material quality and the generic and formless quality of them. I think he kind of thought these were interesting because in a way that will allow us not to start by designing of a form, but instead to focus more on the performance and also on the material quality of the furniture, of the items. So basically we started very simple by recombining different materials with different qualities, like wood, perspex, and some monolithic material as concrete or stone. And by arranging them in different ways, we kind of reach a certain degree of flexibility that allowed us to introduce movement in the collection. Like for instance, in this coffee table you see, it's composed by 3 stacks of material. And we thought it could be, at first, I must say, exciting just to give them, to animate them and to bring them to life, also to achieve a certain degree of flexibility, so that you can change them according to your needs or to your mood also.
We go on to these 3 blocks here and explain a bit what this piece can do.
This counter is kind of iconic, the piece of this collection, and this has like 1.20 meter height, so like it performs as a wall, but when it moves, you can sit on the lower surface, and middle surface you can use as a walking surface. And I mean, obviously the 1.20 is standing height, so like the, you can use as a counter to meet together shortly or whatever.
Also, we thought it was very exciting to have the chance to use mechanical industrial components as bearings, which usually they never really apply to furniture. So it kind of, this will bring a further quality and also give us the more a mood of a workshop. So it's more, as Benjamin Pardo was saying, it's more, it's not about the office, but it's about work. Today you can work everywhere or can have informal meetings either at home or in an office space. So we thought it could be interesting to have this sort of ambiguity achieved through the flexibility and kinetic quality of this thing. So yeah, it's also surprising to experience the furniture.
We're in an architecture office, architecture studio. Why this move for OMA? Why do we see this furniture range coming out of this world-famous architecture practice at the moment?
Well, I think OMA somehow has always designed some bespoke furniture and fittings through all their projects. And also there is a long collaboration going on with Prada, so OMA design sets for the catwalks. So there is already a sort of engagement in the ephemeral design somehow. But then just only lately, REM accepted to engage into industrial design. I think it somehow started from his own personal experience about designing furniture for himself. And he thought it was interesting to explore this other side of the design work.
And does, for you as designers, is there an influence from the architecture, from OMA? You know, are you working in kind of collaboration somehow with the kind of work that's coming out in terms of the architecture here?
Yeah, of course, since we started working here, I think we got lots of inspiration from the other projects.
I'm not sure how we achieved this, but we thought that maybe a common quality between the architecture and this collection of furniture is that counteracts some pre-constituted thoughts about what a furniture could be. So a furniture has to be static, while I think the word itself, at least in Italian, it means that it's something that moves or that you can that move. So we tried somehow to make this really evident with this collection.
That was our David Pleasant there at the Rotterdam Offices of Architecture Practice, OMA. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of Section D. Fear not, we'll be back next week with paddles at the ready for London salvage firm Lasco's inaugural auction. And we'll take a look at a new proposal for the Australian Prime Minister's residence too. Today's show was produced by Alad John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Alad at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in honour of the summer solstice, here's Solange Knowles with Sandcastle Disco. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Baby, I-